From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with one of America's most prominent film directors, Sidney Lumet. His movies include 12 Angry Men, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, Network, and Running on Empty. 26-year-old screenwriter Daniel Waters has been getting rave reviews for his first movie. The movie is Heathers, a black comedy about high school social life and teenage suicide. Coming up, Waters shares some high school memories. And jazz historian Lauren Schoenberg tells how Red Norvo forced the jazz world to take the xylophone seriously. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Sidney Lumet is one of today's most prolific film directors. He's known for being fast, dependable, and frequently under budget. His movies include 12 Angry Men, Long Day's Journey Into Night, Failsafe, Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, The Wiz, Prince of the City, The Verdict, Daniel, and The Morning After. That abbreviated list will give you some idea of the range of his subject matter and style. Lumet's latest film, Running on Empty, has just come out on home video. Christine Lottie and Judd Hirsch star as a couple who in the late 60s bombed a government-funded napalm laboratory and unintentionally blinded a janitor inside. The couple has been living underground ever since. Their 15- and 10-year-old sons have grown up on the run with their fugitive parents, constantly changing homes, changing names, even hair color, to elude the FBI. Much of the story is told from the perspective of the older son as he comes of age and considers coming out from the underground. River Phoenix was nominated for an Academy Award for his performance in the role. Sidney Lumet has directed around 40 films. He told me how he got to make this one.
It was a fairly usual setup on this one. The studio had been developing it for about a year. I was under contract to the studio, and they were about to put it into what we call turnaround, which is... We don't want to do it, fellas. See if you can get a deal at some other studio. And at that point, I'd just heard about it, discussed among a couple of people, and asked to read it, and I did. So it was fairly straightforward.
What about the story appealed to you?
I think the most important thing to me in it is the moment of breakup, really, between parents and children. Naomi Foner, who wrote the screenplay, said a remarkable thing one day when we were working on the script. She said that parents and children are the only love affair in which you can measure the success of it by how well they break up, since the breaking up is inevitable. And I was very moved by that, and find, certainly among my friends and my own life, that that is not an easy point in one's life. And I think it was that primarily that drew me to the script.
Two of the main characters in this movie are people who were radicals in the 1960s and have since been living underground. Do you think it was an advantage or a disadvantage for you to not be of that generation?
Probably an advantage. I think the fact that I wasn't interested in making a nostalgia piece about the 60s probably did the picture good, because it seems to me that fundamentally what it's about is something that's so much broader. And even though most good work comes out of its specificity, and I think we are specific in the movie, I think the fact that I'm not of that generation, that I'm older than that, served as... Well, let's put it this way. The 60s can be an enormous distraction. There's an awful lot of life about it that's very attractive, and yet would not particularly be germane to the story we were telling, even though the political action of the parents clearly was. So I think all in all, an advantage.
Mm-hmm. You've made about 38 movies in a little over 30 years. And it reminds me of the old studio days in a way, when there were a lot of movies being made, many more than there are now, and when directors and actors used to do a lot of movies per year. How have you managed to keep that pace up, especially considering how the movie industry has changed?
Lucky, Terry. I love work and I love movies. I think if I could ever, and these things are clearly impossible, but if I could have had the artistic freedom that I enjoy now, under the old studio system, which would have been impossible, by the way, I think I would have been very happy working in a studio, because I love going from one project to another. I love when I work with actors who I find exciting to work with. I love repeating with them and working with them again and again.
So you think of yourself as having more artistic freedom now than you did when you were starting because of how the movie industry has changed?
Not partially.
Or don't, because of your stature.
Part of it is muscle. You know, yeah. you get a couple of hits behind you and you can slowly start encroaching into that area. But I think you're right. I think the studio system has changed. I don't think that Louis B. Mayer would have given me Final Cut no matter how many hits I'd had. He would have never given up that prerogative.
Now, you insist on that, right? When you take on a movie, you must have Final Cut, which means what exactly?
Well, it means that there can be nothing. The film cannot be touched after you finish editing it, mm-hmm. Whether in the soundtrack or visually. It's yours.
What kind of problem had you run into with previous movies that taught you you needed to demand Final Cut?
Well, as an example, many, many years ago, I did a very, very interesting picture. I think a very good picture. It's one of the few that I like better now than at the time that I did it. A picture called The Hill with Sean Connery. And it was not much of a success in America, but a good picture. And at that time, I did it for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and at that time, they were being owned by a new person. They were changing hands almost daily. There were three new managements in the period of a year. And at one point, they just said it as a matter of company policy that a picture had to run 1 hour and 55 minutes because they thought that this would work well for their relationships with the exhibitors. And the picture ran 2 hours and 2 minutes. And they just insisted that I take 7 minutes out. They didn't care where it came from. It didn't matter to them that there were no 7 minutes to take out without destroying the movie. And it was a hell of a battle, and the only reason I won it, actually, was because management changed hands again, and the new management came in, which was listened with slightly more sympathetic ears. But if the old management had continued running Metro, they simply would have taken the film and removed 7 minutes, period.
Right.
And that kind of thing goes on constantly. A great many directors have suffered very severely from that.
And that's still going on.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My guest is film director Sidney Lumet. His movies include 12 Angry Men, The Pawnbroker, Serpico, Prince of the City, Network, The Verdict, and a new film called Running on Empty. Let's talk a little bit about your first film, made in 1957, and this was 12 Angry Men, a courtroom drama. You had before that been directing television, live television dramas. Was this a good transition to make since it was basically a one-set movie? It's a courtroom drama. It's a jury drama. They're in the deliberation room most of the movie. Was that a good place to start?
It was good, and it was a great problem, except that I was dumb enough not to know what the problem was. I found out after I had done the movie and people liked it that it was very difficult to shoot a movie in one room. That never occurred to me.
Really?
I had just plunged in with complete ignorance, knowing what I wanted to do with camera, knowing that I could make the camera a good interpretive part of the movie itself, and just blithely went ahead, shot it in 19 days, happy as a lark, and didn't know what the problem was. I may have felt enormously secure at the confinement of it, because my background, as you say, had been live television and the theater. So the idea of staging something in one room was something that came very easily to me.
Well, the movie starred Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb. Fonda is the only juror initially convinced of the defendant's innocence. Cobb is the last holdout. I want to play a clip from this movie, 12 Angry Men.
Maybe she honestly thought she saw the boy kill his father. I say she only saw a blur.
How do you know what she saw? How does he know all that? How do you know what kind of glasses she wore? Maybe there were sunglasses. Maybe she was farsighted. What do you know about it?
I only know the woman's eyesight is in question now.
She had to be able to identify a person 60 feet away at night without glasses.
You can't send someone off to die on evidence like that.
Oh, don't give me that.
It's a heck of a cast. In addition to Fonda and Lee J. Cobb, you have Jack Warden, Jack Klugman, E.G. Marshall, Ed Begley. You directed them your first time out on film, and you've since directed Paul Newman and younger actors like Al Pacino and Treat Williams. Is there a difference in the acting styles of the actors who you were directing in the 50s and the actors who came of age in, say, the 70s?
Not really, Terry. The basic craft of acting is, in the United States, has been set for some years, really, even before the method came in. Basically, people like Fonda worked out of a profound sense of truth. In fact, a man like Fonda didn't know how to do anything falsely and used himself brilliantly. Both of those elements are foundations of the method, and even though he wasn't called a method actor in the sense of having studied the method, he basically worked out of that, as most good actors did.
Do you think of yourself as a method director?
No, I become the kind of director that becomes whatever his actors need. When I did Murder on the Orient Express, I could work the way the English actors work. When we did Long Day's Journey into Night, there was a perfect example. Kate Hepburn has a very specific way of working, her own technique. Ralph Richardson is a prime example of British technique, which is primarily from what we call the outside in. Dean Stockwell works completely method from the inside out, and Jason has his own glorious world of creating something from inside himself, and heaven knows where it comes from. But I think part of the job of directing is to not make the actors work your way, but for you to work as a director any way that makes them comfortable.
You directed Al Pacino in two of his first big movie roles, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. I want to play a short scene from Dog Day Afternoon, and maybe you could tell me what you think Al Pacino needed when he was getting started. This is a scene from the very opening of the movie when Pacino walks into a New York bank and he holds it up and he wants the money to buy a sex change operation for his lover.
Nobody move!
Get over there!
Okay. All right, get away from those alarms.
Cut!
Now get in the center. He moves. Take his head off. Put the gun on him! Get out of the center.
Sonny?
I can't do it, Sonny.
What?
I'm not gonna make it, Sonny.
What are you talking about? Put it on.
I can't do it, Sonny.
Sal, what? Where are you? He can't make it.
It's an interesting performance because Pacino is so manic in it and yet so insecure and incompetent at robbing this bank.
Mm-hmm.
What did he need when he was getting started? You were talking before about giving actors what you think they need.
Primarily what he needed was, this is going to sound like an anachronism, and it was, he needed a great sense of freedom and a great sense of restriction. The creation of the character is really Al's own. He understood something about that man that is irreplaceable, and I don't think a director can ever give. He understood him down to his bone marrow. What he needed was a sense of release, the confidence to know that as extreme as he got in the performance, that it would write, that it went. For example, there's a scene toward the end of the movie where he's talking to his female wife, his real wife, on the telephone, trying to decide what to do. And the scene is extraordinary in the sense that it requires a level of emotion that I've seen very rarely in movies. We did the scene in one take with two cameras, because I didn't want him to have to repeat that emotion over and over again. And when he finished it the first time, it was wonderful. And without waiting an instant, I didn't even cut the cameras. I said, Al, go again. And he looked at me like I was crazy because he was exhausted. He was spent. And I said, right now, action. And what I was driving at was that he had reached such a height at the end of the first take, such an emotional peak. But that's really where I wanted the scene to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the best pieces of movie acting I've ever seen. It was blinding in its intensity, agonizingly painful, and just reached a level of emotion that I, as I say, that I don't think I've seen often in movie acting. And that knowledge that he could go as far as he wanted to within the confines of this situation and that man, the situation created by the script, the man created by Pacino, but that confidence to know that he could go as far as he, as his feelings would carry him, was very important to him, and that was really the biggest single directing relationship to his performance.
That's an interesting story. Now, you mentioned there that he really did it very well on the first take, but you wanted that emotional spentness to be the starting off point, so you had him do it again. Now, you're really known for doing a lot of performances on first and second takes, for not going for a lot of takes. I wonder if you ever run into conflicts where there's one actor in a scene who works really well on that first or second take, and another actor who sees it as their style to go for 15 or 16 takes until they really get it perfect. What do you do if you run into that?
I have run into it, and so far, if there were a piece of wood around the studio, I'd knock on it. But so far, I've been able to convince the 15 or 16 take actor that the other works. The early takes are not imperfect. They are usually the freshest, truest. The repetition, I find, and I think for most good actors, the repetitions tend to become mechanical. One doesn't find more truth in it as it goes on. Now, that partially has to do with the way I work, because, as you know, or may know, I rehearse very heavily. I rehearse 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the complexity of the characters, before we begin. And those rehearsals are conducted like theater rehearsals, in the sense that people learn their lines completely, are working without scripts, they're completely blocked, to the degree that we're having run-throughs by the end of it. So it's not as if once we get on camera that this is their first exposure.
Is that uncommon?
Yes, it is. It is. It is not done often. I think mostly those of us who were trained in television do it. I think Arthur Penn does it. I know Arthur Penn does it. John Frankenheimer and so on.
Oh, because you had to do it for the live drama.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And but it turned out for all of us, I think, in movies to have other advantages.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk more with you about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director Cindy Lumet. His movies include 12 Angry Men, The Porn Broker, Serpico, Prince of the City, Network, The Verdict, and a new film called Running on Empty, starring Christine Lottie and Judd Hirsch. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Sidney Lumet is my guest. Now, you really came from a theater family. Your father acted in the Yiddish theater. You acted when you were very young. I think you either performed in or a standby in the Dead End Kids on Broadway?
I wasn't one of the Dead End Kids. I was in the play. There were other children's parts.
It was a play called Dead End on
right,
Broadway. Okay. Right. Now, did this experience with the Yiddish theater via your father and your own performances help you understand actors as a director?
I think so, Terry. The biggest thing about actors is that they really are the infantry. They are the most exposed. And most good work, not just acting, but really any creative work, is a matter of use of self, self-exposure. And as I say, actors are the infantry in that. It's their emotions, their physiognomy that's being examined, rejected, accepted at the actual moment that they're doing it. They're right up there.
Why did you give up acting for directing?
I found that process very invading. When I got out of the Army, I'd been acting since I was 5 years old, and I got out of the Army in 25, and at 25, and went on with it for about another 3 years, and I was primarily a theater actor. I knew that good acting, as I say, is self-exposure to a large degree, and I got sort of embarrassed about revealing those parts of myself to 1,500 strangers a night. If you were in a hit, that is. Otherwise, it was to 50 strangers a night. But there was something about acting that no longer worked for me, and I just slowly drifted into directing.
Did having a father in the Yiddish theater help you love performance?
Absolutely, drama? Absolutely. The peculiar thing is there's a sort of strange post-World War II American problem. Children of actors and writers and directors tend to be nervous and upset, and more than nervous, they're terrified of going into their parents' work. And yet the history of the world is going into your parents' work. I mean, in England, in the Redgrave family, Natasha now is the fourth generation of that family that's become an actor. And fortunately, it's beginning to make some sense in America. Two years ago, I did a movie with Jane Fonda and Jeff Bridges, and I had worked with both of their fathers. I'd worked with Henry and I'd worked with Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very moving. I was thrilled at working with the two of them because that sense of continuity is lovely. It's the way it should be. And I'm quite sure that my father, being the actor he was and bringing me into the theater at a very early age, was an enormously beneficial and happy-making thing to happen to one.
I want to play another short scene from another movie you directed, and this is Network, which came out in 1976. Peter Finch won a posthumous Academy Award for his performance in this. And in this scene, he plays a lunatic, self-styled, messianic broadcaster who is basically preaching his editorial.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crying in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
And right after, as he's doing that editorial, people all over Manhattan in high-rise apartment buildings open up their windows, stick their heads out, and start yelling that they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. I thought that scene really tapped into something, and for me what it tapped into is the fear is that in Manhattan, there's so many high-rises filled with so many people with all this pent-up anger. And if it was ever let loose, we'd really be in big trouble.
Well, Paddy Chayefsky had that unique ability to tap the most fundamental truths in people, in the individual characters, and also in terms of the situation that he was observing. Did you ever see a picture that he wrote called Hospital?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's hilarious as Network is with fundamentally a deeply serious idea behind it, and he did it in that too. I miss him every day.
Network was one of your many movies that was shot in New York locations. Now, I think you were really one of the first directors to actually do location shooting in Manhattan.
Yeah, Kazan first and me right behind him. But at that time, it wasn't fashionable at all. It was very difficult to put together more than one good movie crew because there was that little work going on here.
Why did you want to shoot on location in New York?
Well, once you were shooting in New York, there was almost no choice. We had very limited studio space in those days. So that you had no choice. But also, it coincided clearly with the kind of picture we were doing, which were usually very realistic pictures, pictures that benefited visually from being done on location.
Were there problems when you were one of the pioneers doing that, since crews weren't used to it? The people on the streets weren't used to having movies shot outside their homes or their offices.
Yeah, but they were all good problems. The problems are much more severe now because everybody's so sophisticated. So they not only charge you a hell of a lot more to use their facility, but they're also a little bit more contemptuous and irritated by the inconvenience that shooting makes. In those days, it was glamorous. People were amazed by it, were diverted by it, enchanted by it. So that the problems in those days were actually less severe than the problems now.
You know, between 12 Angry Men, The Verdict, Serpico, and Prince of the City, you've done your share of police and legal dramas. Is this a special interest of yours, or did you just like those scripts and want to do them?
It's funny, Terry. You know, I don't really analyze these things. Mm-hmm. I just respond instinctively to a piece of material. But obviously something in me somewhere is very involved with that level of life. Where it comes from, I don't know, but on looking back on it, boy, there are an awful lot of what I call justice stories. They somehow involve me very viscerally.
Have you been affected by the new craze of market research?
Yes, and fortunately, I've had my artistic controls in place before they ever came along, because I think they are disastrous. I think they're destructive. I also think they're untrue. I think a person changes as soon as you ask them something.
So do you have a no market research clause when you take on...
No, because I can't prevent the studio from doing it, but mm-hmm. I sure in hell don't let it affect any of my decisions about what I'm going to do with the picture.
You obviously love film directing. When you're doing a movie, what's the part that you most look forward to and the part that you know you have to do but you really don't enjoy at all?
There's only one part that I have to do. All of it is a thrilling process to me. Pre-production, shooting, post-production, editing, music. The only part that's a bit of a drag is what we call the mix, which is when we come in and do the final soundtrack and put every chair squeak in and every door slam in. It requires enormous concentration because it's largely a mechanical process rather than a creative one, although some directors use it very creatively. The soundtrack that I keep remembering particularly is the soundtrack of Apocalypse Now, which was a brilliant piece of work and a totally creative piece of work. However, you do have to do it. I feel I have to do it myself, because if the mix is a bad mix, if the wrong thing is emphasized, it can seriously affect the movie and be very destructive to a movie. So I have to do it, but it's the only non-joyful part of movie making to me.
Good enough.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Terry.
Sidney Lumet's latest film, Running on Empty, has just come out on video. It stars Christine Lottie, Judd Hirsch, and River Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Three Fresh Airs from today. I'll speak with Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth of the Talking Heads. They also have their own band called Tom Tom Club. And their upcoming visit seems like excuse enough to play something from Talking Heads' latest album. This is Nothing But Flowers. We'll be right back.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bulimia. God, that's so 1987. Well, that's one of the many sarcastic put-downs in the new movie Heathers. Coming up, screenwriter Daniel Waters talks about his new black comedy about high school social life and teenage suicide. Also, jazz historian Lauren Schoenberg profiles Red Norvo, who first established the xylophone as a serious instrument in jazz. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tells us that the way you introduce yourself probably has a hidden meaning. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman. President Bush and congressional leaders stepped into the Rose Garden today to announce a budget agreement for the next fiscal year. All of the participants praised the agreement as an example of cooperation between the administration and Congress, but they emphasize it's the first of many difficult steps in the budget process. NPR's Jim Engel has more.
House Democratic Leader Tom Foley called the agreement an example of the new mood of bipartisan determination to deal with the deficit. Others said it ended 8 years of confrontation and distrust over budget issues with the Reagan administration. But everyone cautioned this is only the first of many steps down a long road. Senate Democratic Leader George Mitchell said no one should think this is the end of a process.
It is the beginning of a process. Very hard choices lie ahead. Much sterner measures will be required in the future.
President Bush said it is a first and manageable step and the first such agreement reached ahead of schedule and not in a crisis atmosphere. The agreement sets down overall spending numbers for categories such as defense, domestic, and entitlements, but the specifics within those broad outlines still must be negotiated. And there is no agreement on how to make up the $5.3 billion in new revenues in the package. All parties praised the cooperation by both sides, but it isn't clear if this is a handshake leading to an embrace or the handshake at the beginning of a fight. I'm Jim Engel in Washington.
The government reported today that wholesale prices rose a moderate 0.4% in March. The figure's release apparently helped ease fears of inflation on Wall Street. However, analysts said that last month's lower-than-expected gain in the producer price index does indicate that price rises will persist for at least the short term. The Commerce Department today reported a $2 billion increase in the nation's merchandise trade deficit in February. The trade gap widened to $10.5 billion. Imports were up more than 5%, while exports rose only 1.5%. Testimony ended at the Oliver North trial today as the prosecution and defense both rested their cases. Final arguments to the jury will begin next week. Nina Totenberg has this report.
On this last day, five witnesses testified in rebuttal for the prosecution. Perhaps the most effective witness of the day was Mary Dix, who was in charge of all the finances and personnel at the National Security Council from 1984 to 88. A small, meticulous woman, Mary Dix described Oliver North as a man frantic for money in 1984 and early 85. Twice in the office, she said, he became so angry when there wasn't enough petty cash in the till that she heard him and came out of her office to find him red-faced and upset. On three other occasions, she said, as she was leaving for the day, North came running after her, yelling, "Mary, Mary." He'd say he didn't have enough money for gas to get home, or he didn't have enough money for lunch, said Mrs. Dix. He was so upset I would go into my purse and give him my money and then reimburse myself. Mrs. Dix said she'd been so struck by the urgency of North's financial need that she reported it to the White House security officer in 1984. In the spring of 85, however, she said, North's demand for money ended. That was also about the time that the profits from the Iran arms sale began flowing into Swiss accounts. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration today ended its special inspections of Chilean fruit. The inspections have not revealed any evidence of poisoning since traces of cyanide were found in two grapes last month. FDA Commissioner Frank Young said the cooperation of Chilean officials, greater consumer awareness, and lab tests combined to end the need for those enhanced inspections. A federal jury in Los Angeles today found the Federal Aviation Administration and the pilot of a small plane equally to blame for a 1986 collision in which an Aeromexico jet crashed, killing 82 people. The jury spent 5 months hearing the testimony and deliberated over 10 days. Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 41 points to close at 2337.06. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Lauren Schoenberg is a jazz historian who also leads his own jazz repertory band. From time to time, he'll be joining us to profile some of the pioneers of jazz. This week, Red Norvo, a man who did for the xylophone what Coleman Hawkins had done for the saxophone, that is, legitimize it for jazz musicians and audiences alike.
Imagine you're a young musician in New York trying to get some new music recorded in 1933. As we all know, 1933 was quite a year. Franklin Roosevelt and Adolf Hitler both came to power, and all over the world, countries were fighting a crippling depression. It was the worst of times to try and get anything new recorded. The record industry had been hit hard, and whatever new music they had indulged in the late 20s was a thing of the past. This makes it all the more amazing that a 25-year-old xylophonist would even try to record himself, much less accompanied by a piano, bass, and a bass clarinet. But that's exactly what Kenneth Red Norvo did. That's the Dance of the Octopus, and nothing like it had ever been heard before. Inspired by Claude Debussy and Bix Beiderbecke, it came out pure Red Norvo, and it set the stage for a series of recordings unique in the annals of jazz. Norvo first came to the attention of the music public and of musicians while a member of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra in the early 1930s, and he also met his first wife, singer Mildred Bailey, while in that band. Red's first recordings were made in 1931, backing Mildred on a recording of what was to become her theme song, Hoagy Carmichael's immortal Rockin' Chair.
Old rockin' chair got me, cane by my side. Fetch me that gin, son, or I tend your heart.
Norvo and Bailey were married in 1933, and they spent the next 3 years working in the radio and recording studios of New York. Dance of the Octopus was recorded during this period, and it was followed by a pair of classic sessions produced by the legendary John Hammond. The first one finds Red leading an ensemble of future band leaders, Jack Jenny on trombone, Charlie Barnett on the tenor sax, Artie Shaw on clarinet, and on piano the one and only Teddy Wilson. Here they are on I Surrender Dear. A few months later, Red was back in the studio for the second session, this one with trumpeter Bunny Berrigan, tenor man Chu Berry, and the great drummer Gene Krupa. This is something they did called Bug House. Thank you. Partially as a consequence of these recordings, Red set out as a leader in 1935 with a small group that featured the sensitive writing of Eddie Sauter. And although there aren't many instruments present, the variety of textures that Sauter achieved are really striking. This is something they played called Gramercy Square. Everybody had a big band in the 1930s, and the following year, Red expanded his band to 12 pieces. Imagine a full big band playing softly enough so that you could hear Red's xylophone. Certainly, Mildred Bailey never sounded better than she did with this band, with arrangements hand-tailored by both Norvo and Sauter. This is You Leave Me Breathless.
You leave me breathless, you heavenly thing. You look so wonderful, you're like a breath of spring.
Although composers such as Duke Ellington and Alec Wilder loved and supported the band, it finally broke up in 1939, along with Red and Mildred's marriage. Mildred sang up until her death in 1951, and Red has continued to have a most distinguished career. In an age where jazz is still viewed by some as a young man's art, it would do us all well to pay homage to one of the true pioneers of the music, Red Norvo.
Lauren Schoenberg leads his own band in performances of classic jazz. Their new album, Solid Ground, is on the Music Masters label. This is Fresh Air. Maybe when you were in high school, you had revenge fantasies about getting even with snobs and jocks who put you down. Heathers is a new movie, a black comedy, about making that fantasy come true. It's set in a high school in suburban Ohio. The school's three most popular girls are gorgeous, wealthy snobs, each named Heather. Their good friend Veronica, played by Winona Ryder, shares the Heathers' good looks and great clothes, but not their meanness. Veronica decides she hates her friends, so she and her boyfriend kill them and the school's other greatest offenders, and then disguise the murders as suicides. Our film critic Stephen Schiff called Heathers nothing less than brilliant. The screenplay was written by 26-year-old Daniel Waters. He attended James Whitcomb Riley High in South Bend, Indiana. But this interview does not begin with the predictable story of how he hated high school.
My high school years, I greatly enjoyed them, and I always remembered them as far from the point of view of a writer. Even in high school, I was like the class writer. I mean, I had a column in the school newspaper, and I used to write stories about everyone in high school during my high school years. I had a very privileged position in high school in that I could move from clique to clique. I was kind of a cult figure in my high school as someone who wrote about the high school and without really being traumatized by it.
Well, this movie really has a lot to do with anger and hostility and jealousy, competition. Did you feel those kinds of emotions?
Not. It's so weird. I mean, in many ways, I really didn't feel that kind of anger. The anger in the film is less against the high school experience than just the way people treat each other in general. I mean, just there's certain personality traits that you can't attribute to teenagers or adults. And I think those are the things I'm kind of attacking.
What was the initial idea for Heathers, or the first image that inspired the screenplay?
Well, it's tough. I guess I always wanted to make a Stanley Kubrick teen film. That was that was the very first burst, you know. It was something that kind of detached, cynical perspective in the world. And I think just the way that teenagers are being treated now in the media, I think that was definitely the spark that got me going as far as writing it. We have this complacency about teenagers now that they're drug-infested, angst-ridden disaster areas, you know, always wanting to commit suicide the first chance they get. And I kind of wanted to break that malaise open a bit.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the story of Heathers. Part of the story is this fantasy of murdering the most unbearable kids in the school, the kids who are too snobbish, too beautiful, too wealthy, too much the bully. Did you ever have a fantasy like that, or do you think it's a common fantasy that high school kids have?
Yeah, I mean, I think it plays in this fantasy of seeing people that usually cause suicide in high school end up committing suicide in this film in a weird kind of way. I mean, sure, there's always these personality types that you always wish that you always make up a more complex scenario, like the school is being hit by a tornado and you have to save everyone, and you have a choice between saving someone nice or letting this, you know, cool person die. And usually in that situation, you let the cool person die. I mean, usually you don't really have fantasies of going out and picking up a gun and shooting them, but it's always these kind of complex fantasies that you give the situation.
The murders in Heathers are disguised as suicides. And of course, this gives you, as the screenwriter, the chance to mock how suicide has been handled by teachers and by the media, even by parents. What are some of the things you've seen in the media coverage of suicide that have really bothered you?
Well, I mean, it's bizarre that, I mean, I think suicide's treated as like this wonderful, mystical thing that solves your problems. Even films about suicide, they usually show the person committing suicide and then everyone being racked with pain and guilt and suffering and, oh, why did he or she have to die? And it's like, that's not really a deterrent. That's, you know, that is, you know, almost pornographically tapping into everyone's fantasy.
The fantasy, yeah, that if I died, then you'd really love me. You'd come to my funeral and realize how much you miss me.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, it's scary. And I think I wanted Heathers to kind of say that when you die, the world is going to carry on in its own twisted way without you, and it's going to abuse your spirit as much in death as it did in life. So you might as well just hang in there with the rest of us and fight your own ground.
There's a lot of fake exploitational sensitivity on the part of teachers in the movie, where teachers come into the cafeteria and have all the teenagers hold hands in a display of emotional support, and this is only because they know that the TV crews are coming in momentarily.
Yeah, yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, depression has taken on a whole different realm now. I mean, when you used to be depressed, at least when I was a teenager, it was always, well, I'm sorry, you're depressed. Why don't you take a walk? You know, go read a book. Now it's, have you thought about suicide, John? You know, suicide has suddenly been put on the menu as a way of dealing with your problems. I mean, I wanted Heathers to kind of like almost shame suicide, kind of take it off its throne.
Writing in all these murders planned to look like suicides gave you the opportunity to write a lot of fun suicide notes.
Oh, indeed. I mean, it's very how this whole suicide culture with, you know, Sylvia Plath and everything like that. I mean, it's fun to it's definitely ripe material for a satire.
All right, we did a murder. Now that's a crime. But, if this were like a suicide thing, you know? I mean, hey, you can do Heather's handwriting as well as your own, right?
You might think what I've done is shocking.
Yeah. To me, though, suicide is the natural answer to the myriad of problems life has given me.
That's good, but Heather would never use the word myriad.
This is the last thing she'll ever write. She's going to want to cash in on as many 50-cent words as possible.
Yeah, but she missed myriad on the vocab test 2 weeks ago.
That only proves my point more. The word is a badge for her failures at school.
It's good. Have you done this before?
I was really surprised that you wrote this movie from a girl's perspective.
Well, that was one of the forces behind Heathers. I mean, that I wanted to write an intelligent female character, as especially in television. I mean, any teenage girl is obsessed with, you know, cute guys and nice looking blouses and nothing else. When in literature, and the kind of literature that I loved when I was a young guy, I mean, you may think I'm kind of weird, but I had an obsession with kind of the literature of angsty young girls, and I wanted to have fun with that. I mean, it was amazing. A book I despised in my youth was Catcher in the Rye. I mean, I hated that book. I mean, here's male dissatisfaction at its purest, and it was just, you know, whining about nothing really important to me. But when I saw the books of like Joyce Carol Oates, Willa Cather, and Carson McCullers, I mean, these are girls that are going through a lot of pain, a lot of interesting, complex things. And I mean, if Holden Caulfield had to go ride the emotional roller coasters that they do, I mean, he'd wet his pants, I think. I mean, another favorite book of mine, I mean, I've mentioned this before in some other interviews, is that The Second Sex. I mean, I read The Second Sex in almost a less of a feminist way than a mercenary way, and that I saw all this great material for movies. In fact, I mean, I think Heathers is very much based on one particular chapter, the chapter on the young girl in her book.
What does Du Bois say that you based your movie on?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of great stuff. I mean, a lot of great stuff. I'm talking about the entire persecution of the female race, and I'm calling
stuff. Really, is there a line that really inspired your movie?
Yeah, well, just the way they maintenance their own oppression. I mean, I think that when girls get together and be friends, that there's a lot of just infighting and power plays that to keep each other down that don't exist, I think, between male friends.
Are there any high school movies that you really like a lot?
I mean, actually, I like a surprising number of high school movies that I would never tell you.
Oh, come
I've
on.
Liked. I mean, a lot of people on the set, you know, they always saw Heathers as the ultimate anti-John Hughes film.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I actually like Pretty in Pink. I mean, I actually like Molly Ringwald. I mean, I watch those films. I laugh at them. I think, you know, Heathers is a lot different. I think the problem with these John Hughes films is they tend to see teenagers as kind of separate from the rest of the world, and that the rest of the world is evil and somehow teenagers are innocent. And Heathers is saying that, I mean, evil is not something that's determined by age. It's something that's part of every human being, no matter if they're 4 years old or what.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Daniel Waters wrote the screenplay for Heathers. It just opened in selected cities and opens nationwide later this month. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. What are you following, Robert?
Well, we're following the Oliver North trial. Last day of testimony. We'll hear about it from Nina Totenberg. Also, news of the federal budget. Linda Wertheimer is reporting from Capitol Hill. But the real centerpiece this evening is a special report on the 50th anniversary of the publication, this is, of John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. Our producer, Peter Breslow. Did I say Peter Breslow?
Yes.
I should have said our producer, Peabody Award-winning Peter Breslow, for his ascent up Everest, will be presenting a very interesting piece following the trail of migrants from Oklahoma to California today, on the anniversary of the Grapes of Wrath's publication.
Well, congratulations to Peter, and thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Introducing ourselves to one another can be a subtle business. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explores the hidden meanings in how we greet each other.
I almost got taken in by one of those telemarketing people the other day. The phone rings, and this guy says, "Hello, Jeffrey, this is Warren Packer." And I'm thinking, Warren Packer, where do I know Warren Packer from? So to mark time, I say, "Oh, hello, Warren," all the time trying to figure out who this guy is. And then he's five sentences into a pitch about a time-sharing deal at Lake Tahoe, before I realize that, of course, Warren Packer and I have never actually had the pleasure. But by then, we're having a conversation, so to speak, and I have to summon up deeper sources of rudeness just to get off the line. Now, I should have known better, because this particular linguistic ruse was pointed out a number of years ago by the linguist Chuck Fillmore, who likes to think about things like the complicated rules that govern the way people greet each other and introduce themselves. For example, one of the things that Fillmore observed is that when you introduce yourself over the telephone by saying, "This is so-and-so," you ordinarily expect that the person you're talking to will recognize your name, which is just where this telemarketing guy was trying to snooker me. Your respondent doesn't actually have to know you. In fact, when I call an actual acquaintance, I'm more likely to say, "Hi, it's Jeff Nunberg." But if I'm calling somebody who doesn't know me from Adam, I ordinarily have to say something like, "My name is Jeff Nunberg." Of course, if you're a celebrity like David Letterman, you can dial a number at random out of the phone book and say, "This is David Letterman. What color underwear do you have on?" Not long after I got the call from the telemarketing guy, I was trying to make a reservation at a popular restaurant, and I considered trying to bluff it out by saying, "This is Jeff Nunberg. I need a table for 4 people at 8 o'clock. But I couldn't go through with it, and besides, it probably wouldn't have worked, since the head waiter would figure that nobody who's famous enough to introduce himself to a total stranger as "This is so-and-so" is going to be making his own reservations in the first place. What's most interesting about the "This is so-and-so" introduction is that it's so thoroughly modern. It came out of nowhere to meet the particular needs of electronic voice communication. You wouldn't use it in a letter, for example, and when you meet somebody face-to-face, you don't expect them to stick out their hand and say, "Hi, this is Joyce Hansen." Other than over the telephone and airplane intercom, in fact, the main place you hear the form is right here, gentle listener, on the radio. It's true that you also hear people on TV introducing themselves with "This is so-and-so," but then it's usually when the speaker's talking off-screen. If a commercial opens up with a shot of a car standing alone on a mountaintop, you might hear a celebrity's voice saying, "This is Biff Benedict asking you to test drive the new Wasabi V6. But if the celebrity is standing next to the car, he's more likely to start by saying, "Hello, I'm Biff Benedict," or "Hi, Biff Benedict here." That's another thing about television, by the way. It's only when the person introducing himself is visible that he has to say hello or good evening, as if the conversation really were face-to-face and he could see you sitting there on the other side of the screen. An invisible announcer doesn't have to greet you. If you can't see him, then he can't see you either. We like to think of English as a language that doesn't stand on ceremony. We marvel at the Japanese, who have to choose among half a dozen different ways of saying "I" and "you" according to an elaborate social code. But I wonder what an ordinary Japanese businessman must think as he tries to master the subtleties of American electronic introductions. I guess inscrutability cuts both ways. From San Francisco, I'm Jeff Nunberg.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, the legacy of the Vietnam War with Jonathan Schell. He was a writer for the New Yorker magazine during the war and has just published a collection of those pieces. You may also know Schell as the author of The Fate of the Earth, a reflection on living in the age of nuclear weapons. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by the Ralph Peterson Quintet. It's an album Kevin says is one of the best neo-bop albums he's heard. And television critic David Bianculli checks out a new episode of The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, which is being revived by the Lifetime Cable Network. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our show is produced by Danny Miller, Ed Doherty, Fred Landro, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle, with research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.